The exhibition is composed of 7 chapters. It starts here at the beginning, and it continues here and continues down. If I lose you somewhere in the middle of the road, I'll start with sharing with you some of the itinerary that I did with this exhibition. I started to work on this exhibition after creating another photographic archive of 40 years of the Israeli occupation of West Bank and Gaza, under the title of Act of State 67-2007. And in that archive, what I saw are many procedures not only of oppressing Palestinians, but of creating the separation between Israelis and Palestinians. And every separation that is created more and more frictions, more and more zones of frictions between Israeli and Palestinians, which is, of course, the complete other side of this perverse idea of achieving separation between people who are sharing the same land. And when I finished working on that archive, I was persuaded that I must go back to the beginning, to the formative years of the creation of the State of Israel, and to see what I learned from there. And I had 2 decisions when I went to the archive, and most of the photographs that you see here, except 10 photographs from a Palestinian photographer, Ali Zaharour, most of them are coming from official archives, Zionist archives, army archives. And I had 2 decisions. One, which was obvious, to suspend the Zionist story of independence, as for me it was quite clear at the time that independence cannot be achieved, of course, through the oppression and the expulsion of other people. So I couldn't follow this narrative, but I also was a bit reluctant toward the narrative of the Nakba, not because the Nakba didn't take place, of course it took place, but speaking about the Nakba, about the catastrophe of expelling people from their homes in terms of a catastrophe of other people, in terms of it is their catastrophe, in terms of it is the catastrophe of the victims, while what I saw in the photographs was a catastrophe, point. A catastrophe by all means, not a Palestinian catastrophe. So I decided to suspend these 2 meta-narratives and start looking at the images. And what I discovered was much bigger than what I expected to see in the archives. Not in some sensual term like I found corpses or I find massacres that I didn't know about them. No, I think that we know today most of the massacres that took place. And if you look at the exhibition around, you won't see many images of massacres. First of all, I am not a fan of showing images of massacres, and then there are not so many images. There are documentation of massacres, but not images. So what I found, which was completely bigger than what I expected, was not in terms of number of corpses or massacres, was in terms of the way that historians, since 1948, actually adopted the sovereign point of view of the State of Israel, which is the point of view that Israeli and Palestinians are having had a conflict since the 19th century, and this conflict culminated in 1948 by this war, the war called War of Independence by the Israelis, in which Israelis were victorious and Palestinians were the victims. And when I started to work in the archive and I started to reconstruct the photographs, what I saw are not images of war. What we are looking at are images of a policy, images of violence, which is part of a policy of transforming the land of Palestine into the State of Israel. I'll give an example. For example, for many years there was a dispute among historians if the expulsion of Palestinians was a planned program by the Israeli regime, or was it spontaneous decisions of some brigadier here and there. And when I started to view images showing the expulsion of Palestinians, what shocked me immediately is the protocols of expulsion that I was able to reconstruct from the photographs. For example, the supply of buses. 750,000 people did not evaporate in one day. They were supplied buses by the army. And prior to giving them buses to be to achieve the border of the new state, the population was splitted into male and female. Female, of course, included children and the elder people. So what I saw in the images are phases of expulsion. And when you see phases, you understand that there is a program. There are means to be supplied to achieve the program, to implement it, etc., etc. So what I saw in the archive was something that I called, following the German philosopher Walter Benjamin, I called it constituent violence. Because the images of violence that I saw was not violence of war. It was violence that created the new law of the state, the new law of the Israeli state as a state of the Jewish citizens, and not as a state of all the population that lived there. And in order to create this law, the violence was required, because the Palestine was full of Palestinians. Palestinians were the majority. But in a period of 2 years, approximately, from the day after the declaration of partition plan by the UN until what is called the end of 48 war, 750,000 Palestinians were expelled, and they became a minority of 150,000 that left in Israel. So what I understood is that we are speaking about a transformation of the body politic of the governed population as it was under the British mandate, the transformation of this body politic into a body politic that will be adequate to a Jewish regime, to a Jewish government. So this is why the expulsion was one of the means to achieve what was called at the time, what is still called today, the Israeli democracy, a democracy for the privileged Jewish citizens of the land. So what I try to do in the exhibition is, for example, the first chapter, which is called Military Governmentality, which is this mixture that was there since the beginning, which is the mixture between governmentality, which is the way that states administer the population, but the way that the state administered the population was a military way. So you see here a photograph from this series, the first series, in which you see the transformation of the local population, both Jews and Arabs, not only Arabs, but Jews and Arabs, into population that now is administered in a military way. And one should understand, when we suspend the point of view of two opposing sides, two sides, two enemies, a conflict that lasted from the 19th century, and when we look at the images, not in as images showing Palestinians against Jews, but we look at them as the moment when this relationship of enmity was created, what we see is that the Jewish population is also administered by the military state apparatuses. And what we see is that in the same way that Palestinians, the minority that was left in Israel, was put under military government, and here, Jeremy, just above you, here in this panel, you have a few images of the transformation of the Palestinians from political subjects roaming freely in the road, downstairs, left below, in Jerusalem, roaming in the street the day after the partition plan was declared by the UN, and protesting against the partition plan. And above, all the other three images are the implementation of the military government under which Palestinians in Israel lived from 48 until 66. Parallel to this, we have also the mobilization of Jewish citizens into this ideology of life equal military life. In Tel Aviv, for example, many male did not want to be drafted to the army, many Jewish men. And Tel Aviv was put under curfew in 48 for 1 week. For 1 week, the Jewish population was not allowed to go outside of the houses. 3,000 soldiers were spread all over around in Tel Aviv with many dogs, and they went from one house to the other to compel the male Jewish population to be drafted, compulsory draft to the army. So we have to understand that the violence, what I'm calling constituent violence, is the violence that had to produce Palestinians as the people who are subordinated to the Jews or as refugees, and had to create or to constitute the Jews as the master of the land. It was not clear for the Jews at the time. I'm not speaking about the military and the political leadership, but I'm speaking about the normal people in the, living in all over the country. It was not clear for them that they are the master of the land. This had to be produced. And what the exhibition is trying to reconstruct is this, what I'm calling the fate that cannot separate Jews and Palestinians since 48, because in the moment when Palestinians were transformed into refugees, the Jews were transformed not only into citizens, they were transformed into the perpetrators who transformed Palestinians into refugees. And when you understand this as something that is inseparable, as far, as long as Palestinians are kept refugees, and they are kept refugees all around the world, the Jewish population in Israel is kept perpetrators. And I started to work on this exhibition from a conscious of being a second generation of perpetrators. And I don't want to be perpetrator, and I don't want to be a descendant of perpetrators. And this is why I think that the fate of Jews and Arabs in Israel, in Palestine, or where, however we will call this land, is linked together in a way that their fate should be changed together. So the exhibition, although it shows many images which are for me images of atrocity, although we don't see in them, as I mentioned earlier, corpses, but these are images of atrocity, because destroying what you will see, for example, in this panel and in that panel, architecture of destruction, destroying houses of people, for me these are images of atrocity. And although the exhibition showing images of atrocity, I hope that the way that I'm trying to articulate images and the way that I'm trying to articulate history in a civil way, in a way that goes back to 48, before the local population, Jews and Arabs together, was completely mobilized into this ideology of enmity between the two people, I hope that this creates potentialities in the past in a way that we can at least start to imagine another future, a civil future for this land. So after speaking about this first series of military governmentality, what I'm trying to do in this series that you see in face of you is socialization to the state and the mechanism of subordination. And I'm trying to see it in the photographs, the way that, the, for example, here in this photograph, again, the beginning of the military government under which Palestinians were put, I'm trying to see the relationship between Jews and Arabs, the relationship that created the Israelis as military governors. They were not military governors prior to this moment. Or this image, for example, this image that I can find very easily in state archives, and it is an image that can be printed in any album of celebration by the state. You know, there are albums that were produced one decade to the Israeli state, 2 decades to the Israeli state. This is an image that the state is very proud of, because we gave Palestinians equal citizenship. This Palestinian woman is showing to the camera her identity card. At the time, it included also Arabic on its cover. Today, it doesn't. But anyhow, the state is very proud because we gave Palestinian citizenship. So we can read this image as it is read by the state as a moment of being proud of we give Palestinians citizenship. But speaking about giving Palestinians citizenship as if we are very generous, here starts the problem. But the problem is not only there. The problem is what is outside of the frame. And what is outside of the frame in the moment when she is getting allegedly equal citizenship is the expulsion of 750,000 people who will not be allocated the Israeli citizenship. And also these kind of photographs that were taken by official photographers in the moment where Palestinians were invited to participate in the first election. But what we have to understand is the way that the campaign for the election took place in Nazareth, for example, where the photograph was taken, where, for example, the Communist Party was not allowed to distribute its manifestos and its campaign, because the Communist Party was the only one who at the time tried to protest against what was done to Palestinians. And for example, in the images here, maybe Omar, we can close the door. What interests me in this image, for example, is the way the discourse of modernity was promoted in the very good tradition of colonial discourse. Here we see an Israeli teaching a Palestinian to use the new agriculture tractors that we bring to Palestinians, of course, after taking their lands and after destroying all the areas where modernity was linked to Palestinians. For example, after destroying Manshir. Manshir was a neighborhood in between Tel Aviv and Jaffa. Manshir was the modern neighborhood of Jaffa. And Manshir was destroyed because Manshir was a modernist Palestinian neighborhood. And in a way that, and Haifa also, you can see here an image that resembles on this panel, an image that resembles a lot images that we know from Dresden, for example, of bombarding a city from above. You see a lot of ruins. 200 houses were destroyed in Haifa as a planned policy by Ben-Gurion not to keep Haifa as it was while Palestinians were the majority of the city. And this also helped transform Haifa, which was a modern city, into a city in which the Jewish are the dominant citizen. And But Palestinians cannot claim anymore that it was their modern city. So the destruction, and this will lead me to the third series that you have here, the destruction is also something that I'm trying to undermine as an abstract concept, because we are so used to speak about destroying Palestinian houses because it is a policy, it is a project that continues until today. 200,000 houses were destroyed since 48 until today. And we speak about another demolished house. And what I'm trying to do in this series of architecture of destruction is start to restore, to reconstruct the language of destruction, the way that they destroyed differently different houses, the way, for example, that in the Tveria they destroyed a whole old neighborhood and they kept only a synagogue. A synagogue that, paradoxically or not, was kept for many, many years by Palestinians who lived around. Or, for example, images of Jaffa, which also you can see on this panel, in which we see a very nice neighborhood, a very dense architecture, that sometimes if we go to Italy, we are looking for such landscapes. But here it was promoted as a very problematic, dangerous quarter with hygiene problems that we must destroy. So the way that the hygiene ideology was, for example, mobilized in order to justify destruction. And we see other images of destruction here. We see, for example, soldiers putting dynamite in a whole village, then going away and taking their pictures when the smoke below behind them. So, and we see them looking at the camera and even smiling and even very glad with taking a souvenir of themselves with the destroyed neighborhood. And here I'm coming to a concept which interested me a lot in this exhibition, which is the transformation of the catastrophe either into a non-catastrophe or into a catastrophe from their point of view. And I'm trying to ask almost about each and every photograph in the exhibition, how comes that what we see here is a catastrophe, but the internal spectators in the photographs do not recognize it as a catastrophe? So I'm trying to reconstruct this moment when the catastrophe lose its features as a catastrophe and become a kind of landscape, the landscape of catastrophe. At the end of the exhibition, downstairs, the last series deals directly with it, and I call this series Looking at Their Catastrophe. Until 10 years ago, before the creation of a Jewish organization, Jewish-Palestinian organization, called Zochot in the middle of Tel Aviv, information about the Nakba was really rare among the Jewish population. The propaganda machine, the state machine, created narratives that didn't allow the narrative of the Nakba to emerge out of many remnants of the Nakba, which are scattered all over in the city. All over in the city, we even use sometimes Palestinian names like Sheikh Muniz, like Somel, like other places that we call them in their names, and we see ruins all over. And until 10 years ago, there was no narrative that enabled us to go beyond what Anne Stoller is calling a colonial aphasia, when you don't find the adequacy or the link between what you see and what you can name. And until this organization was created, organization that created as its aim to promote the memory of the Nakba, there was no narrative, there were no information that we could gather in order to understand what was 48. And as part of leftist community, the occupation of 67 was so urgent in terms of protesting against it, because every day the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza create another justification to protest against it. So the story of 48 somehow seems to me and to many other colleagues like a story from the past, like a complete history, as we are used to deal with history, as if history is a fait accompli. And I think that since the creation of this organization in Tel Aviv, where this exhibition was shown for the first time, history of 48 was perceived as a complete history. And what I'm trying to do in this exhibition is to create this history as incomplete, to create this history as a history, as a potential history in which we can intervene. And in order to intervene in this history, what I learned through the exhibition is that, first of all, I have to reconstruct through the photographs the way that, as I said before, the two sides, Palestinian and Jews, was created at that time. But there was something else that was created at that time that cannot be reduced to Israeli Jews, and this inadequacy between the two pairs that I will present in a minute, the second one, is exactly the place through which I'm trying to create this potential in the history that I'm narrating. The other dividing line that was created in 47, 48, 49 is the divide between people who recognize the catastrophe for what it is and people who do not recognize the catastrophe for what it is. Somehow, there is a quiet parallel between people who recognize the catastrophe being Palestinians and people who do not recognize the catastrophe being Israelis. But luckily, there are some fracture between this parallel, and there are few Israelis who start to recognize the catastrophe for what it is, as a catastrophe. But many times, when Israelis start to recognize the catastrophe, the Nakba, when they start to speak about the Nakba, they speak about the Nakba as their catastrophe. We have to understand that parallel to the independence of the State of Israel, there was another narrative, the narrative of the Nakba, the narrative of the catastrophe from the point of view of Palestinians. And what I'm trying to do in this exhibition is to go beyond that, to go beyond that in a way that we will reconstruct not only the way that the constituent violence created the two opposing sides, but it created also this dividing line between population who cannot recognize the same catastrophe as a catastrophe. So the idea is to understand that not recognizing the catastrophe of expelling people from their homes, of destroying their house, of dispossessing them from their property is part of the catastrophe. Or saying it again in a clearer way, not recognizing the catastrophe is part of the catastrophe that was created in 48 and continue until today. And this is why recognizing the catastrophe is part of stopping the catastrophe. This is why, if we understand that not recognizing the catastrophe is part of it, we can start, for example, by recognizing the catastrophe, and this is what I'm trying to do in this exhibition. And just one word about the last image of the exhibition that you will see downstairs, and then we will open it for questions, and maybe we will make a tour together. When I worked on this exhibition, I tried effortlessly to find images of Jews and Arabs working together, living together. In these years, I found many of them in the 30s. I found not many of them, but some of them in the beginning of the 40s. But I wanted to keep the lapse of time from 47-50, and I wanted to find images of Jews and Arabs together at that time. Jews and Arabs together not only in moments where they are expelled, for example. And I couldn't find in Israeli archives. Then I was very lucky to find some of them in Bristol, but it was after the exhibition was shown and the book was printed. But before printing the book in Hebrew 2 years ago, I found one significant image for me that is at the end of the exhibition. That is an image where you see a catastrophe, which somehow has little to do with what we are speaking about, because it is the struggle against the British Mandate. It is the struggle of another Jewish militia against the British Mandate, against the raffinery in Haifa. And there is a huge cloud of smoke that you see there, and below, in the frame, you see Jews and Arabs together. I cannot say among those who do not wear keffiyeh if they are Jews or Arabs, but I presume some of them are Jews and maybe some of them are Arabs, I don't know, but I can say definitely that those who are wearing keffiyeh are Arabs. So I can presume that I'm watching at an image of a mixture population looking at a disaster, which is the explosion of the raffinery in Haifa. And what for me is very significant in this image is that we are at the very last moment when Jews and Arabs can face together the catastrophe. Because in all the other images later on, since 48 and until today, the Arabs will be the first suspects of any catastrophe that will take place in the public sphere. So they will immediately be arrested. They will immediately be separated from the Jewish population. And what we see there is a last moment of Jews and Arabs sharing a world where they recognize together a catastrophe. And this is the image that ends the exhibition, which is, as I said before, for the entire exhibition, it's an image of atrocity, but for me it's an image of hope, because seeing Palestinian Jews sharing the possibility to recognize a catastrophe together is exactly what is needed today to overcome the what I call regime disaster maintained by the Israeli regime since 48 until today. So maybe I'll stop here, and if you have questions, I would love to answer them. And
I guess from your kind of description of the archive, I can't help but sort of be aware that the archive itself is a kind of curated entity that, I mean, perhaps like you say, there's not a graphic illustration of violence within it, and you only see the traces of that. I don't know, and I don't know much about kind of official photography in that period, sort of among sort of Jews, Israelis, and I don't know if there's something you could expand on the process of kind of curating from something that's kind of itself curated.
What is itself curated?
Well, something like a national archive.
Okay, but what you see here are images coming from around 12 or 15 different archives. Okay. It's not that I found this archive as an archive. I gathered images coming from 10, 12, 13 archives, and I composed them as an archive, and I declared it as an archive when I understood that what I'm having here is much more than a collection of images about 48. When I understood that what I can narrate through these images is something that go beyond any existing narrative on 48. And this is why I declared it an archive, because I wanted this grid that I am suggesting to be the beginning of a new discourse and not the end of this discourse, that I can show it one time and take it on back. I would like to share this exhibition with this archive with as many venues as possible, with as many people as possible. So this is why I declared it an archive, although I do not own the copyright to show them. We bought the copyrights for this particular show. We bought the copyrights for printing the English book, and we will buy the copyrights for any other showing of this archive. But this archive does not belong to me in terms of the property of the images, and it does not belong to me because I think archives do not belong to persons. Archives are public. Archives are to be shared with others. And as for the question about official photography, the challenge in working, in creating this archive, was to work with official photography, to see how there are so many things written on the surface of the photograph that if what I can tell you about what is written on the surface of the photograph, even before a profound research, if it will be a written document, it will be closed for the public eye for 60 years or for 50 years, depending which country you are living. So what intrigued me is the way that the catastrophe is there. It is written there. The images are disseminated, but they are not speaking for themselves. The catastrophe is not seen. This is why these images can be printed in celebration albums of the, produced by the state. So the challenge was to take official photographs from official archives and to read them against the grain. Some of the photographs were taken by very good photographers like Ben Rothenberg, like Zoltan Kluger, and Hans Fein. And some of them were taken by soldiers, for example, and you can recognize the quality, sometimes not with very good cameras, sometimes they were kept in very bad conditions. But some of them are brilliant photographs that can be bought by any, any collection of the Tate Gallery. So there is a mixture of photographs, mixture of quality, but each and every photograph in the exhibition is, for me, an historical document that I can read, and I can read not only as a testimony about the past, but as something that has a potential to be read differently than the way that it was kept and preserved through the hegemonic discourse of the state.
Yeah.
As you just said, a photograph doesn't speak for itself necessarily, and it can be approached and interpreted in different ways. And that's why, I mean, the way you group your pictures and you explain them help us, the audience, to interpret it, to see them from a specific angle. My question is, how did your audience in Tel Aviv, when you told me that you had this exhibition, in Tel Aviv as well, how did the Jewish-Israeli audience interpret these pictures? How did they approach them?
It's a complex question because we cannot speak about the public in general, but I'll try to characterize some of the events that, or some of the incidents that were around the exhibition. First of all, it was shown at Zochot Gallery. Zochot is this organization that I mentioned that is promoting the memory of the Nakba. So the public who usually come to this space is a public that is interested by the memory of the Nakba. Doesn't mean that everybody agree about what is the Nakba and what is to commemorize the Nakba, but it's an interested public. But the public that came to the gallery was much bigger than the usual suspect of Zohot space. For example, I during the 3 months where the exhibition took place, I was there almost every day, and I met classes. I tried to persuade all my colleagues to bring their classes into the gallery, and I had this kind of discussions. It was very important for me to speak with people about what they are seeing. And for example, two classes came together. There were 100 students, all of them 20, 25 years old. They came from Jerusalem, from Bezalel Art Academy. And it was a horrible experience for me. They told me at the end, so if it is so bad here, take your suitcase and go away from the country. And it was even harsher than that. I mean, it was a very, very bad experience. But it was one of them. There were others who were amazing. For example, I remember a meeting with 20, 25 women, all of them Palestinians, Israeli citizens. And they were around 30s. They were grad students in Haifa. And they described, all of them, that until 10 years ago, they also didn't speak about the Nakba. They didn't know about the Nakba. So it's only in the last 10 years that they started to speak with their parents and their grandparents about the Nakba. So this also was a fascinating experience to understand how even the private memories, even in private houses, the state intervened in many ways in the way that the Nakba is commemorized or the way the Nakba is debated at home. So this is another example. And maybe the last thing that I would add about the Israeli public will be the silence of the press, the silence of the official press. No one line was written on the exhibition or the Israeli or the Hebrew book, although the book sold one edition. So it's not that it was not disseminated, but it was not disseminated through the hegemonic media. But maybe I'm in a good society, because in a good company, because when Occupying Wall Street started, also for 2-3 weeks, the hegemonic media didn't write about them. So we know very well that we live today in a very heterogenic covering of our activities, and the hegemonic media is one of the state organs in most of the states, and especially in Israel. So it's not surprising that this exhibition was not covered by the press, but there are other venues, alternative venues, to disseminate information today. And we see it very well with the Arab Spring, how it influenced the whole Western world today. It's not through the hegemonic media.
Just an entry about the press. Most of these state or photographs taken by soldiers who were obviously part of this activity. But were there any press freelance photographers at that time taking photographs, or were they not permitted?
Even the freelance photographers, once they wanted to arrive, for example, to a village from which Palestinians were expelled, if we can speak about them in terms of being free, they lost their freedom at that moment. Because in order to enter, for example, they had to be in negotiation with the army. And I think that the propaganda at the time, that we are in an existential war, was so strong that I think that voluntarily, many of the photographers that consider themselves or even behaved or even practiced their profession as freelancers, they were mobilized to the state. And you can see it, for example, if you look at a wonderful book by Ben Rothenberg, which was, it didn't work for the state. But when you read his book and you read the captions that he gave for images from that time, it is as if he worked hand with hand with Ben Gurion. I mean, there is no distance between them. So speaking about freedom of speech, speaking about being freelance, speaking about, it's very complex at that moment and cannot be reduced only to the way that officially photographers consider themselves being freelance or embedded.
Was there a specific brief which they were instructed by the state? What kind of photographs were they instructed to take as a documentation?
I think that this is a research to be done. I didn't do it, but I can answer to this question from another point of view. I will answer it in relation to an image that you can see later on downstairs. This is an image. Maybe we can pass the book. It's a very pastoral image, when the caption is also very pastoral. It is classified in the archive as a fula, as an image of Palestinians harvesting the field. And who knows a little bit about how art history, and who recognize Mie, for example, the gleaners, can recognize immediately that we are not speaking about a snapshot, an image that was taken in haste when the photographer was there. We can recognize that the photographer composed his frame, he thought about his frame, he did it in relation, in references, not only to Mie, there are other precedents in art history of gleaners, how do we take them in picture. And when I'm speaking about the time that it took to take this photograph, and I will come in a moment to describe what we see in the photograph, which is not harvesting the field. But when I'm speaking about the time that it took to take the photographs, I'm speaking about a kind of contract or a brief that he got from the soldiers there, because there are five soldiers there. They are always there, a gun, not a gun, how do you call it, the long one?
Stamp.
Whatever.
Rifle.
There are always there rifles. So the photographer cannot just go there and take a snapshot. So there is a kind of negotiation. And what I learned from this negotiation is not only that he got the time, but he was not allowed to go closer to the situation, because otherwise, being a photographer, you have your ethics of a photographer, and if you see, for example, a corpse below, you are taking photograph of a corpse. You will see downstairs nearby this photograph, a photograph taken by the Palestinian, by Ali Zahour, and is, of course, taking the image of the corpse. So what we have in this image, when we start to look at it carefully, what we see is that, first of all, the Palestinians are not harvesting the fields because there are no harvests around them. So they're harvesting nothing. And when we continue to look closely at this image, we see that they are not really in a field where there is harvest, but they are in a pit. And the pit arrives until their knees. So they are digging. They are not harvesting. And when we continue to look closer at this image, we see that the soldiers, all of them, all the five, have white handkerchief on their nose. It means that it smells very bad there. And I tried with historians' colleagues to see if we can locate a massacre nearby or a battle nearby where a corpse had to be buried. And I couldn't locate the photograph. Although we were with these historians with which I worked, we confirmed that we are not speaking about a fula, but we are speaking about one of the neighboring villages, El Zarin or El Ajun, one of them. But as I said, I could not reconstruct the particular event that took place there. But I was able to reconstruct through oral history, which I heard a lot of oral history at the time, I could reconstruct the same procedures the Palestinians repeated endlessly to people who interviewed them, that they were compelled to come to one place, there were soldiers around them, and the soldiers put their rifles toward them, and they were compelled to bury the corpse. And what we see in this image, for example, for me, is two protocols. We see one protocol, which is the protocol how Palestinians were compelled to bury the corpse of their fellows, and it is completely in relation with all the descriptions that I heard. And the other protocol that we see is the protocol between the Israeli Jewish photographer and the army, because the Israeli Jewish photographer is going back to the archive and is classifying this image as harvesting the corpse. And I can reconstruct all this not through finding a document in the archive telling him how to take the photograph, but I can reconstruct it from the distance that he take towards the subject that he's taking in photograph.
Just to say, I find your argument for an expanded concept of catastrophes is very powerful, and I'm just wondering, you mentioned about the lack of curiosity of historians and anthropologists in Israel to make close readings of these sources and to look at what's outside of the frame. I don't know if you've got anything to say about that. And I'm just, you know, some of the images, some of these like staged images, I was looking at the tractor with the an Arab being taught how to drive. I mean, they're sort of familiar within British colonial archives. Also, they're quite familiar. So I'm wondering by what mechanisms are historians not curious or are not going there?
First of all, I think historians, most of them, ignore photographs as documents. And in many history books, when we see photographs, we see at the end, in the best cases, when they use photographs, at the end we see 10, 20 photographs, and you have captions like the Iktik caption, saying, this is the Battle of Verdun, this is the Battle of I don't know what, but they don't read it as a document. These are most of the historians, doesn't mean that all of them. Unfortunately, in Israel, this disease of historians is even worse. They don't read images. If they would read images, all this dispute about, for example, planned or not planned, the expulsion will be, I don't want to say solved or determined, because we cannot determine anything regarding history, but would have more material, I think, to debate. They are waiting to find, you know, the final instruction of Ben-Gurion to expel all the 750,000 Palestinians. No, they will not find this document in the archive. But there are other documents that testify that it was planned. So I think that it is, first of all, part of the habitus of historians not to look at images. But we see today many other researchers looking at images. These are people who are coming from women's studies, people who are coming from post-colonial studies, people who are doing visual culture. They are intrigued by images and they are reading images. And what we see, this exhibition, for example, in Israel, it gave, I think, the point of departure for other historiographic projects looking at images. We have to start somewhere. And there are other projects that were inspired by it and continue to do it. So the images are there. The images are accessible. And paradoxically, they are accessible much more than written documents. And the information they contain is sometimes much bigger and richer than what we have in written document, because in a written document you have what a certain brigadier ordered his soldiers to do. So you have one point of view or one order or one decree that is written in the document, while in a photograph you don't have only the point of view of the photographers. Because if I would have only the point of view of the photographers with which I answered Ram about harvesting the field, I will repeat like a parrot the official discourse. But in the photograph there are many other details that are recorded through which I can narrate a different story. So the lack of curiosity is not something, is not due to a personal ability or to talent. It is due, first of all, I think, to the way that the historiography or the historian, the profession of historians was instituted, was established for many, many decades.
Can I ask a question? So we really have here more than just a very complex reading of the images. But there's a lot of use of the word narrative. There's a lot of subjective conjecture about what is around. It's almost as if there's a poetic voice rather than the historian's voice. Where does that? How did you make a decision about this? Did you think? I mean, because the text is very carefully written. How did you control that voice, or did you not want to?
You mean the personal voice?
How yes,
do I educate myself not to express what I feel, what I think?
Because occasionally you feel like there's another, your voice is talking almost from behind the picture, and it can, I assume that sort of puts you in an interesting position where you could be accused of over-interpreting.
Yeah, I know. These people who are writing, harvesting the fields are not accused for overinterpreting. They are accused. They are not accused. They are praised for writing history. So this is exactly the type, the kind of history that I am trying to avoid. I'm not writing history as historians write history, but I'm writing history. And what I'm writing is potential history. And potential history for me is a combination of genre of writing, genre of viewing, genre of documents, and what you call subjective, I would call
poetic.
Okay, poetic it's better, because subjective...
Yes.
So, yeah, there are many voices in the captions that I'm writing. Sometimes they are poetic, sometimes they are blamatory, sometimes I'm asking questions because I don't know. And I have no one else to address except you spectators. Help me to understand what is going on here. And sometimes I'm claiming, and sometimes I'm describing, and sometimes I'm getting into a dialogue with the official caption. For example, if you will take, again, the caption of Harvesting the Fields, I'm quoting the official caption, and I'm trying to get into dialogue with it. How can this caption was... How it passed... How it was passed to the archivist at the archive. Mm. So I'm speaking about the distance from the corpse in order to see it as a picturesque picture. And what I'm trying to do also is, this is maybe what give it the allure of being poetic, but what I'm trying to do is not to respect the frame, is not to speak only about what we see in the frame, because if I have to speak only about this, I can say, this is a wonderful woman, she's smiling, she got her ID, and nothing else. But the idea is how to contextualize this photograph in a way that go beyond the frame that was decided by the photographer. Because the photographer had a kind of brief that he got from someone to describe how we gave Palestinians the identity. So the idea is to read beyond the frame. But the idea is to produce history which is responsible, no less than what we know as positivist history. And to understand that writing history of Palestine, Israel, of these years by a Jewish person that was brainwashed since I was born in the early 60s to believe in the Zionist agenda cannot put aside the way that I am getting rid of the brainwashing. So this is where my subjective voice is there, because I have to struggle against this propaganda. It's not only speaking about the photographs as if I'm looking on photographs of another planet. Writing history for me is not writing only the past, is struggling in a way that the past is still perceived in the present.
I tweeted yesterday, from Palestine to Israel, then what?
A what? Sorry.
What next?
What next?
Yeah, because your title is From Palestine to Israel.
I think.
Then what?
If I can just second this. The title of the exhibition, as I said, in Israel was different. It was Constituent Violence 47-50. And when the book was about to publish by Pluto Press, we had a long negotiation about the title, and the title that we achieved was From Palestine to Israel. This was the title that we agreed upon. And we had a lot of discussions. It was not easy to achieve a title because the press wanted Nakba in the title, and I opposed the title of the Nakba because the Nakba, although it is denied in Israel, it is very good for marketing. But I... resisted against Nakba, and we had a lot of very interesting, challenging discussions, and we achieved this title. And then the graphic designer of the book suggested me the cover with this image. I was surprised, because it was not the immediate or the first image that I would choose. But after putting this is not exactly the cover, you have the cover all over, but the title and the image, it was on my desk for a few days, and after a few days, I was so happy, like Eureka, I found it. Because what this title creates, what we see here, is Palestinians expelled from Palestine, and Palestine is becoming Israel. But when we look at this image with this title, we have refugees coming back from Palestine, wherever it was when they lived for 63 years, coming back from Palestine to Israel. So the only thing that I can tell you that you can tweet to friends in Palestine is that the land between the sea and the river should be the state of all its citizens, which means that all Palestinians living there and those who were expelled from there should be part of a new body politic that defined the regime that we would like to have. And the regime that we would like to have, if we will be a mixed population again, will not be what we have today.
Okay, I'll take one more question maybe, and then if you want to hang around and maybe buy the book or ask questions personally. Anyone?
Thanks for your presentation. Thanks very much. I wanted to ask, what I find most interesting is that you talk about intervening in history, right? If you call it the potential of the
plan? Yeah.
the potential of history, right? I think this is one of the most, I would not call it the most useful. As you can use the images to rank potential history. But I found it a very, very interesting concept, especially when you see these images that have been in archives for 60 years and do not allow for something else to pop up, right? Do not allow, this is the written history of it. So I was wondering, if you now suggest, the Nakba will transform the Israelis back into kind of citizens, and Palestinians also, again, into citizens, right? We would not have this, the perpetrator and the victim going on. What then, this moment is a kind of utopian moment also for you, right? What would happen, if this would happen at all, what would happen to the meaning of this archive then? How do you see the... How do you see the use of the images that you see here that you call an archive? How do you see that? Would it transform to something that it is not doing now? How would you read it then?
I always dream about to be there, but I never thought or never asked myself how would it look like. Retrospectively or retroactively to this archive, because there is so the way is so long until we will be there.
Yes.
But I'll try to answer your question, and my answer will be with another concept that I'm working on in relation to Israeli-Palestinian history, is the concept of forgiveness, to forgive. And what I have to suggest to the discourse of forgiveness is something very specific that is based on this archive, is that in every photograph of atrocity that you see here, we have the seeds of forgiveness. Because we have not only those who something bad has done to them, we have those who did it. So in each and every photograph here, we have seeds of forgiveness. And these seeds of forgiveness, contrary to the way that we think about forgiving as something that concluded the past, forgiving is a process between those who were perpetrators and those who were victims to the same act that linked them forever together. And this is a process of learning, this is a process of sharing, this is a process through which the way that they share the world is redefined by both of them. And what is happening between us and Palestinians from 48 until today, that we share a world. We share a world. We cannot say that we do not share a world. All those who speak about Palestinians there and Israel there are lying. They are more than utopian, if we can call separation of utopy. We share a world. The problem is that the way that we share the world is still is under the mode of violence. The constituent violence that I'm trying to track down in this exhibition is preserved all the time by the law of the state, by the sovereign state. So we share the world. The question is, can we start a process of forgiveness through which we will change the way that we share the world? So this is the way that I came to redefine what is forgiveness through this exhibition, and through the exhibition that you know very well, Potential History, that was the outcome of this exhibition.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was brilliant. Thank you very much.